Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Starseed Radio Academy, empowering Starseed to better serve the planet.
Welcome to Starseed Radio Academy. It's Tuesday, September 10th, 2013, and I'm your host, Arielle Taylor, with my co-host for the evening, Lavendar. Anastasia is on special assignment until next week, and then she'll be returning with the Starseed News. Our featured guest this evening is Dr. Courtney Brown, a mathematician and social scientist who teaches in the Department of Political Science at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. But independent of his work at the university, he is also the leading scholar on the subject of remote viewing, as it is done using procedures that were developed by the United States military and used for espionage purposes, or procedures that are derivative of those methodologies. Dr. Brown is the director and founder of the Farsight Institute, a nonprofit research and educational organization dedicated to the study of a phenomenon of non-local consciousness called remote viewing. He's here with us this evening to talk about his recent Atlantis project, using remote viewing to uncover the truth and lessons about that lost civilization. So this is sure to be a fascinating show. His websites are farsight.org, and that's FARSIGHT.org, and farsightpresentations.com. At the top of the show, we'll be joined by Holly Brettschneider, president and founder of BoutiqueProfits.com, and one of our Starseed sisters who's offering a free webinar called Wealth Wake-Up Call, Discovering the Heart, Soul, and Mindsets of Success. It's taking place tomorrow, September 11th at 12 p.m. Eastern, and the web address is BoutiqueProfits, and that's B-O-U-T-I-Q-U-E, Profits, P-R-O-F-I-T-S.com, /landing/wealth-wake-up. And the link is on our show page if you didn't get time to write all that down. Holly was with us on our Spring Crystal Quest, and this new direction in business was inspired after her reading with Lavendar. We'd like to thank Fiona and Chris for hosting our switchboard this evening, and you're welcome to call in with comments or questions. The number to dial is 917-889-8292, and remember to press 1 on your keypad so we know you want to come on the air. If you like our show, we'd appreciate your support by clicking follow on our show page. And if you're joining us for the first time, our main site is starseedhotline.com, where you can find a lot of vital information for Starseed in our Vault of Knowledge. And the entire site has been coded for Starseed activation. We have a forum for Starseeds at starseedhotline.ning.com. And we'd like to thank Rose and Tammy for their great work and dedication on behalf of our Starseed forum. You can also find us on iTunes if you'd like to download our shows to go, or download them right from our show page archives. Before we get started, I'd like to let you know that if you want to contact us privately, the toll-free number for our website is 888-881-0881. The Stage 1 Starseed confirmations are based on Lavendar's discovery of star markings in your natal astrological chart, and the Stage 2 session is a one-on-one phone session available with Lavendar, Anastasia, or myself. Remote healing sessions for people and pets are also available with Tammy. If you have a birthday coming up, you should know when your 10 hours of power will occur by getting your solar return timing. And please allow at least 2 weeks ahead of time to make sure that you get it on time. And if you'd like a Stage 2 reading to interpret your solar return energies beyond just knowing when the window is, make sure you book it about 2 months before your birthday, because we do have a waiting list. So now I'd like to introduce my co-host, Lavendar. Hello.
Hello. I'm really excited about both guests that we have tonight, so why don't you go ahead and bring Holly on?
All right. Just a second. Let me get your mic open, Holly. Hello, Holly Brettschneider. Welcome to Starseed Radio Academy.
Hi, Arielle. Hi, Lavendar.
Well, we are really excited about this new project that you've got. So why don't you just kind of tell us how this came about and what you hope to accomplish with it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm so excited to be here. I feel such a kinship and family with you all, and I'm thrilled to be here. It feels like kind of a little homecoming. So I'm so glad to talk to you. I can give you a little summary of where I kind of came through and how I ended up where I am today. I was just reading again listening to my reading from Lavendar, and I'm like, oh my gosh, yep, that came true and that came true. I mean, it really has been an amazing time. So a little bit of background about me. I started out as an attorney. I was a lawyer for 12 years and headed up the legal department of a corporation. So I did the whole corporate thing for quite a while. And then about 12 years ago, I opened my first of two retail stationery boutiques in North Carolina after we moved here from California. And I, about 2 years ago, opened up this company, Boutique Profits, because what I really found was my passion was teaching other stationery retailers how to market their businesses and how to create systems in their businesses that help them to increase their profits and their revenues and all that sort of thing. But, you know, I guess a few years ago, I was really studying the law of attraction and trying to figure out what I believed about religion or spirituality, and I felt like I was such a seeker. I was thirsty for information. I would read everything I could get my hands on, and really about mid-2012, I feel like it just all really started accelerating to the point where I just started having this feeling like books were like almost jumping off the shelf at me, like, buy me, read me, and then I'd read that one and be like, okay, now this one, and then this one, and pretty soon, I'd say it was about late October, early November, I tripped across something on some blog post that mentioned light workers and star seeds, and I'd never heard that term before. And I was like, what is that? That's interesting. And so I started Googling it and, you know, researching about it. And pretty quickly I found Lavendar's site, the Star Seed Hotline site. And I have to tell you, I just devoured everything in the vault. I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. And I felt like I found like this treasure chest of information. And I still was like, this is really amazing, but I don't know if I'm a starseed or a light worker and all that. So I really wanted to get the star markings reading. And then I found the information about the solar return chart reading. And I was like, oh my gosh, my birthday is in like 2 weeks. I have my birthday this last year was on 12/12/12. And
wow.
I was like, I feel like that's an important day and all this stuff is coming at me. I feel like I need to have this solar return reading, but my birthday was in 2 weeks. And I sort of like took a flyer and sent an email off saying, is there any way that I could be on a waiting list if there's a cancellation or something? I know you guys have a long waiting list or a long lead time. And then I think you, Ariel, got right back to me and said, well, you know what, just try calling this phone number. Sometimes Lavendar has an opening, sometimes she can squeeze you in. So I tried the phone number thinking, okay, yeah, I'm just going to get a voicemail and we'll see. And Lavendar picked up, amazingly. And I told her my little story about how I was turning 48, which adds up to 12, on 12/12/12, and I just found out about her solar return. And she was like, wow, okay, let me see if I can find room in my schedule. And miraculously, I think in 3 days, from that phone call, I was having my solar return reading with Lavendar.
And wow.
It was, to say it was amazing was like the understatement of the year, because I've played the recording back, I've transcribed it, I just like drank in everything that Lavendar was telling me, because I felt like she was telling the biography of a superhero, and I was like, that's not me. Like, she's like, you know, you have like these 8 lifetimes where you've built up these amazing credits in your cosmic bank account and you've ascended 3 different lifetimes. And really, you're what would she say? You're Holly by day, E.T. by night. She's like, yeah, you're a science officer on the Star of Bethlehem. And I was like, I thought the Star of Bethlehem was just in the Bible. I didn't even know it was a mothership. This stuff was so new to me. And I was just blown away, but like in a really good way. And it felt like a huge awakening and a confirmation. And she also was telling me that I had, you know, the markings of the Christ consciousness and Mary Magdalene and the Cathars. And I was like, well, yeah, I think that's kind of interesting. And then she was suggesting that I read Kathleen McGowan's books. And, oh, my goodness. I mean, I devoured those one after the other. And Lavender had said, you're going to have so many releases of basically records in your soul that'll be released as you read that. And I had no idea what she meant by that at the time. I couldn't even fathom what she was talking about. But as I'm reading these books and I'm weeping and going, yes, oh my God, yes. It's like just so many things were opening up for me. And it just totally accelerated from there. You know, December was, she said, you're going to feel like the information is coming at you fast and furious, like you're just drinking from a fire hose. And then you're going to need January to kind of sort it out. And that was exactly what happened. Like December was insane. I couldn't get enough of information, and there was so much just coming at me, but I was taking it all in and like trying to get used to this notion of I'm a starseed and I'm a light worker and all that kind of thing. And then January, I went through this big dip of I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing. It's just crazy. So the as you know, time has gone on. So the other thing that Lavender told me that was so amazing was that you can see how the number 12 has been playing a big, huge factor in my life. I've had 12-year career spans. My birthday was 12, 12, 12, all this stuff. Well, turns out that the Pleiadian star markings I had represented in all 12 galactic time zones around my solar return chart. She was like, Holly, like that's. I was like, do you think I'm from the Pleiadians? And she's like, oh, my God. I might see a couple of those, but, you know, I don't usually see 12, all 12 represented there, on, like, on your chart. So there was just so much that I walked away from it. It was mind-blowing and at the same time hugely empowering, where I was like, you know, I've kind of always felt like I was here for a reason, but I just had no idea what it was, and I still don't quite know what it is, but I'm going to find out now. And so I've just gone on this journey, and this last year up until this point has been one of just completely continuing to open up and step into my power more and more. And here's the thing that I've come to figure out is that all of us starseeds and light workers, we have opened our minds to some like mind-boggling things, right? Crazy things, like just crazy to muggles, as I call them, is that like, you know, we can accept that we're descended from star beings, that there's extraterrestrials among us and in so many galactic races out there. And we're like, oh, yeah, of course. And that we're multidimensional beings, you know, Holly by day, ET by night. You know, I'm a science officer on the mothership. You know, and we can accept that, that, you know, we lived in the time of Atlantis and all these different things. And a lot of us can even accept that we have these amazing powers, like we can be psychic or do energy healings or be amazing astrology readers, all of these things that we can be like, yeah, well, of course, that's the way that it works. What we haven't been able to quite grasp and accept is that we have this amazing power within ourselves to create the results and the life that we want. Actually, I view it as co-creating with our higher selves in the universe, but we have the ability to do it. If we want to live an abundant, wealthy, free life, we can do that. It's right there for us, but we get so clouded over with, you know, the whole, like, sleepwalking, I call it, of, you know, doubts and fears and lack of self-confidence and what are people going to think, what if I fail, what, you know, and really fears that have been developed over eons of time and lifetimes and that kind of thing. But we still hang on to sort of these old stories, the old programming of money is bad, you know, I'm not capable or worthy of being wealthy, you know, all that kind of thing. And I finally come to the realization, I am so clear now that what I'm here to do is to help create a new ending to those old stories, to really help people wake up to everything that's possible for them. And if we can just get out of our own way and, like I say, wake up to our abundance that's right here for us. So it's led me on this journey. And again, I look back at Lavender's reading. I'm like, God, she like wrote my story in a year in the reading where she was saying, you're going to be publishing and doing video and writing. And I'm like, I don't know. And we'll be traveling. And I've been like traveling like crazy. So all these things have been happening. And it just adds that layer of confirmation of like, yes, this is what I'm here to do. And those little like messages and urges that I feel like my soul is like nudging me along is more than just my imagination. It is intuition. It is a connection. It is my soul purpose and my blueprint for being here. So, and she had said that I'd be, you know, writing a book. And I'm like, no, I don't think I'll be writing a book. And guess what? I've outlined a book, a fiction book. So I've gone and I've created an additional direction or an expansion in my business where I was doing this coaching of marketing systems and strategies and things like that. And I was like, gosh, well, what I really am fired up about and passionate about is this awakening of what we're capable of and this sort of spirituality and ascension and the universe and energies and all that. And so I found a way finally to integrate that into my business where I'm like, really, when I look at the success that I have had in my business, especially over the last few years, a huge, if not critical part of it has been this understanding of what we're capable of and how to work with the energies and not against them and get into the flow and all that sort of thing. And so that's what I really am passionate about sharing now. And it was a big test for me because it brought up all of these huge fears and doubts and, you know, I don't know if I can do this. What are people going to say when I start talking about energies and business? You know, people expect me to be giving them,
right,
you know, systems and strategies and tactics and all that. So I finally figured out how to, you know, keep moving through that one and just being like, I can't not share this with people. It is like bubbling up inside of me and bursting out.
I can feel that. And it's such a critical piece because, I mean, I've said before that here we come to this planet with all kinds of abilities and perceptions and frequencies that can be interpreted as power and gifts, but yet somehow the third dimension manages to beat us over the head with a stick. And we're sitting here with, you know, phasers and photon torpedoes and all kinds of, and we still get beat up. So integrating spirituality in the business is so important, and that's probably one of the part of, you know, the worst parts of corporate America is the absence of any kind of spiritual center whatsoever, and they don't have to be mutually exclusive.
You hit on such a fabulous point, Ariel. That's what I've been really wanting to just sort of grab people and shake them and say, it doesn't have to be one or the other. You can do both. You can have both. It's not like, oh, business and wealth and money bad, spirituality, energy, ascension, good. It's like, you know, we're here to enjoy all of it, to experience everything that life has to offer, and you can run your business in a way that you live by the golden rule and you treat others. In fact, it runs really, really well when you run your business by the golden rule and you find business partners to work with that believe and run their businesses with that same kind of integrity, and you treat your customers that way and you market that way, and then things really start being in alignment with who you are at your core, and that's when it all starts opening up. And so that's, I feel like there is still a huge hurdle that we have to overcome about all these conditioned beliefs about money. I mean, so I grew up in a family that didn't have very much money, and, you know, I had to overcome a lot of that to like, unwrap that conditioning of, you know, well, if I were really good, I would give all my money away, or, you know, I want to do good things, so I'm not going to be wealthy. It's like, wait a second, I can do more good things when I am wealthy, so how about if I do both? So it's been very, very fun to start rolling this out.
So tell us a little bit about the webinar.
Yeah, so I created this webinar. We're going live with it tomorrow at noon Eastern time, and it'll be probably about 90 minutes. I'll do a presentation at first to go over some of these concepts and then open it up for Q&A kind of session. And it's sort of an introduction, because what I've also done is I've created a larger program called the Wake Up to Your Wealth program that I'll be releasing tomorrow after the webinar. That's an 8-week coaching program that goes through in a group fashion. You know, we get weekly tutorials that go into all these different aspects of kind of understanding really what is money in the first place and what does it mean to be wealthy, and, you know, in quantum physics, and how does that work in with energy and money and that sort of thing. And then who we are and the power that we have and, you know, all these sorts of things. So that happens over a period of 8 weeks with all sorts of toolkits and templates and resources to be able to implement what's being discussed, not just like, oh, yeah, that's nice to learn about, but like actually putting them in play in our lives. And then it's done in a group setting where it's kind of like helping each other with those different aha moments and struggles or celebrations and things like that. So I'm so, so excited and so passionate and so deeply grateful that I'm sitting here talking about this today, because when I was back there in November with Lavendar telling my reading, I was like, boy, I really like this stuff, but I don't know if I could ever do this for a business. And, you know, here I am living it. And I have to tell you, the further I've gone down this path of like, well, this is what I kind of really like to do, I've had so much support from the universe just sort of nudging me along and giving me these, yep, that's it, keep going, kind of like the hot and cold game we played when we were little.
Yeah.
So I kind of look for those messages. Usually it comes in the form of double digits on the clock or triple digits and things like that. But it's been, especially lately, yesterday I had the most amazing day of synchronicities that I can't even tell you. You wouldn't believe them if I told them all to you. So it's just sort of like, it's like, yep, it's time. Here I am getting ready to, you know, release this thing. And the universe is like, we told you once you stepped into this, it would all open up and here you go.
Well,
so
yeah,
Holly, this is Lavendar. Why don't you give us a couple of minutes of telling us about what you experienced on the Starseed Quest last April?
Oh, my goodness. That was a phenomenal experience for me. I have not ever really been knowledgeable or familiar with crystals. And you told me in my reading, Lavendar, that I had a marking of being able to work with the crystals and have them play a big part in this next year. And I was kind of like, okay. So then I was listening to one of the Starseed Blog Talk Radio podcasts, and you had the gentleman on who is the archaeologist in the pyramids in Bosnia, and I was blown away by that show. And then at the end of it, you guys announced that you were doing another Crystal Quest trip, and I was like, oh my gosh, that would be amazing. I wonder if I have the star markings for it. So I emailed you guys, and you're like, yeah, remember those 12 galactic time zones in your solar return? Yeah, you've got pretty much all of the star markings that we would need for this trip. So I, you know, still did the kind of last thing of like, oh, I don't know if I should spend the money, but I'd really like to go. And finally, I just made a decision of, you know what, if I'm going to teach abundance, I'm going to live abundance, and I'm going to just say, you know, I'm not, you know, sitting here saying, oh, I've got a couple thousand dollars to throw away, and you know, but I just said I really want to do this, and something is like kicking me in the butt to do it. So I made the decision and went, and I was so glad. I mean, Lavendar had said it would be like your soul family, you're reconnecting, and that was exactly what it was. Everybody on the trip, we got along so well. I've made lifelong friends from it. We had so much fun. We had amazing experiences with crystals in two very different places. You know, one up on Fisher Mountain, which is my kind of place, the top of a mountain. It was so pristine and fabulous, where Lavendar shared some really amazing stories from her vault that I just really resonated with Athena and some other things. And I found an Athena crystal. I mean, it was just so amazing. And then to go on the rescue mission to the quarry and to be, it was raining that day. We were sitting in mud. I was covered head to toe in mud, freezing cold, and I didn't stop for like 8 hours just digging. It was an amazing experience. So that was a very, very special trip and a very special place where it's hosted too.
Oh, yeah. Mountain Harbor is our home away from home. It's kind of like the Starseed headquarters for our gatherings, because it's just, there's it's such a sacred place, and the energy is so uplifting. I mean, you can touch it.
And we would go out at night and look out over the lake and watch these amazing sort of light shows, which we believe were sort of the ships coming and going from in the lake. And, you know, some pictures were taken of starships. A few of the people, especially on the trip, could get these amazing pictures of orbs and streaks and ships and things like that. And it was just a whole new experience that was so much fun. And like I said, the the sisterhood. It ended up being all women on this trip, but the companionship and the sisterhood that you feel there is it's indescribable. It's just, you just feel like you've known everybody forever.
That's true.
Yes, you have.
Well,
yeah.
It was.
So
it was,
I just so want you guys to know how grateful I am for the part, huge part that Lavendar, you and your whole, you know, Ariel and Tammy and all you guys have played in my little ascension and stepping into my power here. I'm so thrilled with where I am in my life, and I am so grateful.
Well, and we're very proud of you, Holly.
Mm-hmm.
And so to get to the webinar, is this something?
Yeah, and I have a better URL, and I apologize. I should have given that to you first. It's a lot easier than the one that you had to read off. I apologize. It starts wealthwakeupcall.com. No hyphens or anything, just like all one word.
Okay, that's easier. Wealthwakeupcall.com.
Yep, .com. And they just go and register with their name and email address, and then they'll instantly get all the details for joining the call. And if for some reason somebody's listening to this in the archives and it's, you know, a few days after the webinar, still they can go ahead and sign up, and I'll send out the replay of the webinar. So
that was my question.
It should be.
If they happen to not be able to make it tomorrow, so you just go to wealthwakeupcall.com, and if they send their email address, then you'll send them the what they missed.
Yep, they'll get the replay instantly. Yeah, it's going to be fun. I'm really looking forward to it. It's something that's definitely outside of most people's comfort zone and awareness. You know, I'm not talking to light workers and starseeds for the most part. I'm talking to, you know, people that have been following me for business and retail and, you know, small business owners and things like that. So it's really fun to sort of see the light bulbs go off and hear them kind of stretching their awareness.
Well, it's just a wonderful thing because it's such a critical piece, you know, reconciling the spiritual side of life with the financial third dimensional workaday life, and they more than just don't need to be separate, they must be combined if you really prosper. Because I mean, even if you have great spiritual ideas, you know, if you can't pay the light bill, you can't light up the world, as I've said before. So you have to have, and it's not money that's evil. It's the love of money.
Yeah. Well, it's when money becomes something other than a tool, when you let it control you instead of you controlling it and working with it. And that's the thing that I'm so glad you raised that, because it breaks my heart when I see so many talented people that are. They have so much to offer in energy healings and putting people in touch with their loved ones that are lost, and like just these amazing talents and gifts that they can't share because they can barely, you know, pay, like you said, their light bill or their rent, and they're so struggling with that. And I'm like, no, it doesn't have to be that way. Like, let's look at how we can all prosper, because the more that, you know, one person becomes abundant, they're going to share that abundance in purchasing services from someone else. And, you know, it's just a huge ripple effect that we've just got to get going.
Right. Well, this is a wonderful project, and we are so happy and so proud of you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Lavendar, do you have anything to add? We're kind of waiting for Courtney to show up on the switchboard. I thought he was here, but apparently that wasn't him. So would you like to add anything, Lavendar?
He hasn't come on the switchboard yet?
Not that we can tell.
Okay.
Courtney, if you're on the switchboard, would you please press 1 so we know it's you? We have a lot of callers. A lot of callers on the switchboard, so the only way we can tell.
Well, he's calling in from Skype, so it'll be it should be a Skype number.
Right. I don't see anything that I recognize as that. So, but maybe in the next minute he will.
Okay. Well, so, Holly, I'm so proud of you for doing this and for sharing your story with us about how you have come to to your place of knowing. You know, it's not about belief systems anymore. It's really about knowing who you are and how you've come to be so centered and how you're playing it in the scheme of things. And you've really come to know that. And so I'm really, really proud to hear you going forward with the kind of work that you're doing. Absolutely.
Yeah, Lavina, you're exactly right. It's a huge difference between where I was in November saying, what, really, me? to like, yes, exactly. This is exactly why I'm here. And in fact, I was talking with Jill Renee Feeler a few weeks ago, and we were talking about wealth and things like that. And I said, oh, my gosh, that's one of my missions, one that I've signed up for, whether it was at the Teton meetings or played in lineup or whatever, that I'm like, yes, I'm so passionate about this thing about wealth is good. Let me help spread this word and that kind of thing. And so I feel like I'm here to experience that wealth for myself and show others what is possible for themselves, because, you know, we are here to experience all that abundance. And I'm thrilled that I'm now seeing that that's, you know, and like you said, knowing that that's what I'm here for. I love it.
Let me ask you, when you got home after the Starseed Quest, did people seem to see you differently? Did they say, what's happened to you? You're so different. Did you experience
I've experienced that a lot this past year, and it's hard to separate whether it came, you know, as a trigger from the Crystal Quest or just I have transformed myself and my life, especially over this last year, from this person who was stressed out, you know, type A workaholic, not knowing what I'm supposed to be doing here, to like this calm knowing, so happy and joyful to know my place in the universe and what I'm here to do and all that kind of thing that I have. My husband has said, oh, my gosh, I can totally see the change in you. And, you know, whatever you're doing, keep it up, you know, that kind of thing. And I definitely have, I went to the stationery show in May, and I had my own Breakfast with Holly workshop series, and people were really resonating with that and just responding well to my energy. And I feel like I'm sure that the Crystal Quest trip and the activations there really helped light that up to where it emanates. And I don't even feel it or know it, and they don't even feel it or know it, but it helps people sort of say, oh, yeah, I want some of that energy. So.
Well, that was going to be my question. I mean, you are so much, I mean, you're just bubbling over, and I'm sure that the people around you are noticing that.
Ariel, let me go check my email in the other room and see if he's had a problem. Because he doesn't have my phone number, but he has my email, so let me go in and check. I'll be leaving for a few minutes.
Okay, we do have someone that's in the screening room right now calling from Skype, so I think Courtney is here.
Oh,
I'm
okay,
so excited for this show.
Well, as soon as we find out if this Skype caller is our guest, I will be finding out in just a few seconds. So, well, Holly, we're just really proud of you, and I really encourage everyone to take advantage of what you are offering and just get that vortex, that spin going. You get it going faster and faster, and it attracts more people, magnetizes more people, and people find their way to you. And, I mean, you are proof living example. Less than a year ago, if someone had told you all this, it would have seemed like a fantasy or the person was delusional. And here you are, you know, with amazing progress, change, ascension, all those words. And it's inspiring for other people that are right now where you were less than a year ago, to see that, you know, it can be done.
Yeah. I thank you. I do appreciate that, and I do feel like that. And, in fact, one of the really cool things that has come from this is I feel like my daughter is very open to these things, and she's sort of seen my transformation, and she's very interested, and we have some really interesting discussions about ascension and, you know, how the universe works and what she's here to do and, you know, all those sorts of things. My son just went off to college, so I feel like he was sort of at the very tail end of it, but I feel like my daughter is just a sophomore in high school, and it's so cool to see her lit up about this stuff. So.
Yeah. She's definitely got a good role model in you.
Oh, well, it's fun.
Well, we do have Dr. Brown on the switchboard now. So, Holly, I want to thank you so much, and I know that you're going to do so well, and the people that jump on board with you will also benefit from your energy. It's contagious. It's wonderfully contagious.
Thank you so much, Ariel. I love you, and I'm so excited about listening to Dr. Brown here, so I'm going to hop off.
Okay.
Or you can mute me.
Okay, we will do that. Thanks so much, Holly. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All righty. Well, we are really pleased to introduce Dr. Courtney Brown. Welcome, Courtney.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, this is great. Yeah, I was a little confused about the exact time that you wanted me to be on. One of the emails said 7:30, so I hope this is the correct connection time.
No, that's fine. That's fine. It worked out just fine.
Okay, that's great. Well, I'm so pleased to be back on your show. It's a real great joy. So I want to thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, it's our pleasure because you're here to talk about Atlantis, and that's one of our favorite subjects.
Actually, you know, this is a very important thing for this venue. But before I talk about Atlantis, let me just say that your show and what you guys are doing is so important because what we're going to be talking about tonight, we now have absolutely verifiable data, verifiable, and it's simply not available in any other mainstream outlets. You can't get it in the New York Times. You can't get it in CNN. It's not taught in the universities anywhere. So if it wasn't for you and the others that you work with, this information simply would not get out. So I really want to emphasize before we start talking about it that all of your listeners are actually participating in something that is extremely valuable to the future of the planet, and it's not offbeat because it's not fringe because it's the stuff we're going to be talking about is totally verifiable, and the very fact that it's not talked about someplace else means that you, in essence, are the mainstream. You, in essence, are the people, the people where the information has a venue, has a place to be shown, and other places simply don't have that. So it's extraordinarily valuable for people to realize that this is not fringe stuff. This is the place where you actually get real stuff.
Well, thank you so much, and I have to agree. And, of course, mainstream is just a matter of perception. You know, what's mainstream for the third dimension is not mainstream for the fourth and fifth and upper dimensions. So,
Think of it this way. Yeah. Mainstream can be understood in terms of different ways. If you're talking about percentage of the audience as a definition for mainstream, then you're talking about other venues because you're defining it in terms of where the masses are. But the masses have demonstrated repeatedly over history that they can be led down the wrong path. I mean, look at all of Hitler's Germany. I'm not saying that we have that now, but the point is the whole country got taken in the wrong direction. So look at the American experience with slavery. For a huge number of years, we just simply got taken in the wrong direction. So the point is, if you define mainstream in terms of where the masses are going, you're already lost. However, if you define mainstream in terms of the accuracy of the information and the open-minded approach that you take to the possibilities that may exist based just upon an honest appraisal of the evidence, not suppressing anything, then if truth is your guide, then the mainstream is not where the masses are. The mainstream is where the few are. And so if truth and mainstream are going to be connected, then this is the mainstream.
Well, I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, well, we're going to be talking about Atlantis. So you want to hear about how this actually started?
Well, yeah, I think most of our audience is familiar with the term remote viewing, but you have really jumped into this as in a scientific, very, as you said, verifiable and following strict protocols and methodologies. So to just lay a little foundation on how you
Absolutely.
Approach this.
As you know, I'm Courtney Brown, and I'm the director of the Farsight Institute. And the website is www.farsight, spelled like seeing far, like FARSIGHT.org, O-R-G, because we're a nonprofit. And I am the leading scholar in the subject of remote viewing as it is done using the methodologies that were developed by the United States military and used for espionage purposes, or procedures that are derivative of those methodologies. So, and I can say I'm the leading scholar without ambiguity because I am the only scholar. You see, I mean, I'm a university professor. I do not do this at the university level, but there is no other I do it at the Farsight Institute separately, but there is no other academic anywhere that does this stuff. So I can say I'm the leading because I'm the only. But I actually think even if there were others, I really think we've pushed this faster than anyone could have possibly imagined. And so what it is I'm the chief investigator. I work with people who have been trained in the use of these military or military-derived methodologies. Typically, they work with Glenn Wheaton, who runs the Hawaii Remote Viewers Guild, and he came out of Special Forces Intelligence. And Lynn Buchanan, who came out of an official remote viewing program in the military under the DIA, that's the Defense Intelligence Agency. And they use different methodologies, different areas in the military, try different things. And the best remote viewers of those people I work with, and these remote viewers are extraordinary. Now, as you know, with your audience, you're very familiar with the idea of psychics perceiving things, and sometimes those things are uncanny as they turn out to be correct. And, you know, sort of standard scientists often dismiss it, but you know the probabilities of those being correct by accident are close to zero. So intuitively you knew something was going on. So what we have done is we've gotten to the point where we have people who are trained in the use of these methodologies, who typically have worked a decade or more in mastering these. And it's a bit like playing the piano. If you play the piano 1 week, you can make chopsticks and a few other noises. If you play it 10 years or more and study it rigorously, well, you know, you may end up in Carnegie Hall. So these Right. are the Carnegie Hall performers of remote viewing that we work with. There are many people who have studied remote viewing, but these are the best of the best. And so these people have long track records that are public track records. This is not like you have to believe me. We have all the data up at the Farsight Institute for these people going back years. You can look at their sessions for project after project after project. And so these people are able to, without any advanced knowledge of what they're supposed to be perceived, they're only told there is a target, remote view it. In fact, they're told there is a target, remote view it, by a non-leaning email, so they can't even see my face or hear my voice inflections. They just know there's a target. They go into a room, come out an hour later with 20 pages of detailed data describing this target absolutely unambiguously. Not like vague and foggy images, impressions, but explicit descriptions of exactly what's at the target. And these people get it right. So what we have done here is learned that we can accurately, with enough effort, transfer information across time and space perceptually with our own minds and bodies, and in complete violation with the classical and relativistic laws of physics, telling us that those laws of physics are in fact partial subsets of a much greater, larger reality for which we will need a whole new physics to understand. And what we have now is the ability to use this remote viewing phenomena to study the nature of time, the nature of physical reality, literally to do physics experiments, but also to do what we call operational projects, which is investigations, which is where the Atlantis thing came from. Now, a lot of people, especially in your audience, have impressions, have experiences, what they consider past life experiences. They have beliefs based on myths and legends and all sorts of things dealing with Atlantis. But it's always been a vague, foggy, fuzzy thing. What is it really? And there are ruins that are under the water, and people say, this is Atlantis, and other ruins, that is Atlantis. Well, when we started this project, we were not using the word Atlantis. We didn't want to touch the word Atlantis. All we started with was some pictures that were on the bottom of Google Earth. And these pictures you can actually see if you go to our website, which is farsight.org, www.farsight.org, and click on the third link in the nav bar, which is Atlantis, you'll get to a data page for Atlantis where you actually see the original Google Earth pictures. Now, the first picture is 1,000 miles off the coast of Morocco and Portugal, 3 miles deep. So this was not done by fishing trawlers. Nobody fishes 3 miles deep.
Right.
So there are ruins. There are what appears to be sediment covering a huge urban infrastructure that looks like it was about the quarter of the size of Portugal. I mean, this is a big city. And it looks like a dead ringer for a major set of infrastructure here. And early in, years ago, some oceanographers, scientists, were dismissing this as what they call ship tracks. Now, all of the underwater imagery is gotten by ships that are under contract by the U.S. Navy. So these are originally governmental data. It's very important to remember that. And these governmental data are gotten by these ships under contract. And what happens is these are sonar ships. The ships travel over the ocean, and they are reading with sonar the elevation changes, getting a picture of stuff that's immediately below. Now, normally the ships go in overlapping trips back and forth, and so they cover a large patch of the bottom of the ocean. But if they don't do overlapping parallel trips back and forth, then they go off into the boondocks and produce what's called a ship track. And a ship track looks like a railroad track where you have two exactly parallel lines on either side. And in the middle, which is right underneath where the ship traveled, it's really high resolution imagery. And outside of those two parallel lines, it's really foggy and fuzzy. So a ship track is absolutely unmistakable. Two parallel lines with really sharp imagery in the middle and really fuzzy imagery outside of the lines. Well, I looked at this anomaly on the bottom of the ocean that some of people on the internet were saying, hey, this looks like Atlantis. They wanted to associate that word with it. And the oceanographers were dismissing it as ship tracks. And I said, I know what ship tracks are, and these are not ship tracks, in my opinion. So I said, I need to investigate what this is. So at some point we were going to have a break between projects, and I said, I'm going to start up another project and have these remote viewers look at it. Of course, they couldn't know that we were studying this underwater imagery, and to my knowledge, they had never been given underwater targets like this at all, so they would never be expecting it. So I had an opportunity to assign two of the Hawaii Remote Viewers Guild that work under Glenn Wheaton, who came out of Special Forces Intelligence. Glenn, by the way, was the main character, real character, behind the George Clooney character in the Men Who Stare at Goats movie. So now they called that character, Glenn was an official consultant for that movie, and they decided to call that character, although it was officially, Glenn's real role, they decided to call it Lynn, in a tip of the hat to Lynn Buchanan, who came out of the Defense Intelligence Agency program. So it was really a composite character in the movie between both Glenn and Lynn. But the basic idea is the two remote viewers that we used were Deborah Duggan Takagi and Dick Allgaier. And again, they have a huge extensive public track record of sessions on the Institute's website that anyone can see to show how good these viewers actually really are. And, you know, systematically, time after time after time. And we've got proportions and data that have been published using these viewers in peer-reviewed mainstream scientific journals. So these people have long track records. So I sent them, totally blind, they didn't know what it was, to this target to look at it, to find out what was going on. Well, the remote viewing for this project took about a year. These projects are not quick. Just the remote viewing part of it alone had many targets and many sessions that the student, that the people were doing, the viewers were doing. And it took about a year. And about near the end of it, when, in 2011, when we were wrapping things up, again, throughout that entire period, the viewers did not know anything about what the target was. The target is the thing, of course, they're supposed to be perceiving. In this case, it was the bottom of the ocean, this anomaly down there. Well, about the end when we were wrapping things up, Google Earth announced a new version of the underwater imagery. Some people call it Google Earth 2.0 for the underwater imagery. Remember, these images are not coming from satellite data. Satellite data are used for the stuff on top of the surface, like mountains and cities and things like that. Underwater data have to come from sonar ships. So they announced this new version, and most of the anomaly was wiped away. And so I looked at it, and then some oceanographers jumped out and said, "You see, it's been fixed." Well, I looked at it, and I deal with imagery all the time, and I said, "Nothing's been fixed. The only thing that was done, in my opinion, was extremely high compression algorithms were used to smooth out the motion, the ocean bottom, thus eliminating the color gradient." And on our same webpage, the Atlantis webpage, at the Institute's website, farsight.org, click the third link in the nav bar to get to it, we have the new Google Earth imagery as well. And the anomaly is still there, but it's very clear that the imagery was highly compressed. Now, Google Earth must deal with compressed imagery. The raw data files for these pictures are so big you can never use them on Google Earth. You have to compress it. But if you compress anything too much, the color gradient goes away. And I show on that page, on this webpage, how the color gradient has been demolished, because the evidence of it is in large patches that follow the pixel lines, the color gradient is totally gone, meaning you have just one color. There's no color gradient at all, no variation. If you take a picture of your Aunt Matilda and compress it enough, you don't see her hair anymore or her red lips or her blue jacket. It's all just one solid batch of gray. And so that's what we were getting with the Google Earth 2.0 images. Now, it's important at this point for me to say I am not saying that any individual, scientist, oceanographer, or institute conspired to corrupt the Google Earth imagery. All I'm saying is that, in my opinion, it's immensely clear that overcompression was used in these images, and, in my opinion, that the images were not repaired, but in fact, just the opposite occurred, that the smoothing just obliterated what was, in fact, a very glaring anomaly on the bottom of the ocean. It's still visible, it's just not quite so glaring. And so, in my opinion, I said, I don't trust any image, nor do I trust any official or authoritative dismissal or statement about an image, because even in today's day and age, any teenage Photoshopper can do wonders with imagery. So I just don't trust it. So we need another way to get the truth. So this is the time to actually send the remote viewers down there. Now, we had another target for this project, and that was another target that was off the coast of Antarctica. And in the original Google Earth imagery, it is very clear they have a rectangular pattern of holes, like a checkerboard. It looks like a mining operation where holes were regularly placed. It's clearly artificial. It certainly wasn't whale droppings. And these holes, like a checkerboard, had to be explained. Now, the new Google Earth 2.0 images flattened it out significantly, but not entirely. You still see that rectangular pattern of holes. So I said, this is a story that's waiting to be told. So let me find out what happened. So we sent the viewers to these targets. Now, these targets were those two places, and I covered it in a various times. The first was, what's down there at the bottom of the ocean right now in those two locations? One, 1,000 miles west of Morocco and Portugal, 3 miles deep, and the other, the holes in the ground that are in a rectangular checkerboard pattern off the coast of Antarctica. The second is, what were those places looking like when they were in their prime, before they were on the bottom of the ocean? And the third was, what were those places looking like at the moment when they went under, when they were submerged? What was going on? So we had those three targets. Now, the data that we got back was quite complicated, but the story could not have been clear, meaning these remote viewers were of such high quality that we actually saw not only what's on the bottom now, but we got a good solid picture of what happened during the last 5 days while they were going under. And so we now know what created those anomalies on the bottom of the ocean, who they were, what happened to them. We even know when they were and what they did to cause all of this. We know the entire story. Now, let me say one thing, if you don't mind. Are you Lavender? We're talking with you're Lavender, is that right?
I'm Ariel. Lavender is on the line.
Ariel.
She's listening.
Okay, Lavender's on. So, Ariel, let me say this is really important. The story is sufficiently complicated, Ariel, that we had to put out a DVD, which actually puts it all together, puts it all in chronological order. The remote viewing sketches, these people, especially Dick Algar, he's quite an artist. They're of such high quality. We're not talking about anything vague or fuzzy. We're talking about something that's so over the top in terms of clear about what happened, and what actually is down there. We even have on the DVD a live session done on whiteboard, video recorded under totally blind conditions of Dick Algar doing his session. And so you actually see him under live conditions working this target. And you see him describe this thing at the bottom of the ocean, 3 miles deep, and sort of saying, this is tremendous pressure, and how in the heck did they build this thing down there? Interestingly, we'll cover some of the things about what we actually found. But the interesting thing is that the thing is so complicated a story, we had to put out a DVD that covers the whole thing. So the DVD is available, but we have the first 15 minutes available for free that covers all of the background information right up on YouTube, and it's right on our website. So if you go to our homepage at farsight.org, www.farsight.org, right at the top of our homepage, right in the middle, you see Atlantis, the true story, we must learn from our past. If you click on that, you can't miss it. It's a huge banner right at the top.
Right, I've
you'll
seen
see,
it.
You'll see a web page there and the first 15 minutes, which covers the entire story and the motivation of the entire thing is there. And then what we get with the rest of the DVD, we're going to cover some of it now, but we get with the rest of the DVD all the graphics, all the images, all the descriptions, the live session. You get the entire story like a movie, all put together. So if you want, I can go into some of the unbelievable but true things that we found that actually happened and why we now call it the Atlantis.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, what basically we found was, and we must tell you why it is that we can actually call this Atlantis and why we can say when it actually happened. But basically what we found was that there was an ancient civilization. It wasn't so ancient. We found that, in fact, it only was 70,000 years ago, which is not so long ago. But it was 70,000 years ago, and there was a civilization that had a level of technology that was about 100 years more advanced than ours, meaning they were very close to us, or we were very close to them. There wasn't much different. If you, Ariel, were walking around on the streets of that civilization, you would feel very comfortable with the building styles, with the clothing. You may not understand the language, and some of the technology may look a little spooky, but you'd feel very comfortable at home with that place. It would not feel primitive, and it would not feel so advanced that it would be scary. It's about 100 years more advanced than we are now, which is very close to where we are now. And now, if you look at the anomaly on the bottom of the ocean, west of Morocco and Portugal, the style of architecture, they had millions of people. You should see their rush hour with so many people rushing to work. It looks like Manhattan during rush hour with people taking mass transit, going to work, going to places. But the architecture was of a style that had a lot of vaulted ceiling, a lot of arches. Think of New York around the 1940s and 50s. Think of Grand Central Station, Penn Station, buildings like that, okay? But they also had electric walkways, escalators, and mass transit and so on. But think of that style architecture. Now, the architecture that was down near Antarctica and near that other region did not look like that. That was more modern in the contemporary sense of it, in our contemporary sense of it, in the sense of squared off skyscrapers, buildings that had a lot of rectangular arrangements to them. They went as deep as they went tall, very, very rectangular, very skyscraperish. Warehouses that were a lot of angular, very much like we would see now. And the area 3 miles deep off the coast of Morocco and Portugal, that was a living, working environment. Think of New York City, Chicago, things like that. The area down near Antarctica, that was a military, scientific, industrial location. They were doing mining. They had a lot of scientific facilities, industrial facilities there. They had warehouses. Think of that as a military, industrial, scientific complex. So, what basically happened is, it just sort of by luck, the area down near Antarctica was also involved in an experiment. Now, they actually had a very clean source of energy, some type of crystalline form of energy that had reactors, but the reactors were much cleaner than the nuclear reactors that we use. They could power their entire civilization off of these very clean reactors. But they were also doing something different. They were also involved in a secrecy-cloaked scientific experiment that is very much along the lines of our secrecy-cloaked scientific experiments of today. Remember, these are our ancestors. They're not an alien civilization on a distant galaxy far away. They are us. We are them. We are their descendants, and we are acting now just like we acted 70,000 years ago, secrecy-cloaked science. And so what they did was they were doing an experiment where they wanted to get at the heat that was below the crust of the Earth, and they were drilling. Now, when you normally have a volcano, you have a crack in the crust, lava slowly seeping up through the crack, developing a pocket of heat and steam and other things, and eventually it pops, boom, and maybe a little lava escapes. But it was lava that sort of slowly creeped out through the crack over a long period of time. Well, they didn't do that. Think of the Holland Tunnel or the Lincoln Tunnel with huge boring machines going straight through the crust. They opened up a huge channel that was straight and open and big right through the crust, and they thought they could contain it. And when it got deep enough, they found out it couldn't be contained. Now, Ariel, if you don't mind, let me say something that I think even your very open-minded audience is going to think is a little wacky. But if you let me speak it and let me explain it, it will make sense. And it takes some time to wrap your head around it. But it is true. It is true. It is true. This is what it is. This beloved Earth that we live on is a lousy place to live. This place was never intended for a long-term civilization. This place is not good to be on. We have absolutely scientific data collected by some people who may not be mainstream, but they're absolutely impeccable with the collection of their data. And, for example, Robert Schock, the Boston University professor, has a PhD in geophysics. He has written a recent book, that's S-C-H-O-C-H, Robert Schock, and his book is called Forgotten Civilization. And he deals with locations such as Easter Island and also Göbekli Tepe, which is a huge, hundreds of acres big site, archaeological site in Turkey that has been investigated basically very recently, but is a huge level, a huge area of stone infrastructure that is at least as complicated and sophisticated and advanced as the people who build the pyramids in Egypt, the Giza pyramids. And this location with huge stone constructions was actually buried by the inhabitants, not by accident, but by the inhabitants, as if they were trying to protect themselves from something that was coming from above. So what we have is a planet that is basically exposed to a tremendous amount of solar radiation in what we'd call coronal mass ejections over periods of a few thousand years. And what happens is it basically knocks this civilization down to dirt, and we have to rebuild from complete scratch over and over and over again. For you to have a civilization that is long-term, you need a million years of uninterrupted development. You can't knock it to pieces after every 3,000 to 10,000 years and expect anything to happen from it. And that's what happens on this planet. In addition to solar stuff, the most recent we've had of these coronal mass ejections has been 1859, and that was big enough to electrocute a few people that were working on telegraph wires, burn some buildings down, and completely, you know, wreck the telegraph system. There were one-inch sparks flying off of it. If that happened today, and it happened just the other day, 1859 is not long ago, if that happened today, we would be in hunter-gatherer mode in a matter of a couple weeks, because it would completely knock out the power on our planet, the electric grid on our planet, for possibly a decade. And so these things happen regularly. Now, we can go 1,000 or 2,000 years without having a major meltdown, if we're lucky. But if you go in spans of 10, 20,000 years, it's going to happen. And even NASA says unambiguously, it's going to happen. These things happen over a long enough period of time. And if you look at, for example, other... So basically, mainstream archaeologists say that civilization started 3,000 years ago in the Egypt area and so on. But, you know, they're completely ignoring areas like Göbekli Tepe, because it violates their ideas that they came up with. And so the carbon dating of Göbekli Tepe in Turkey goes back 10,000 years. So clearly, even our archaeological data completely contradicts what you get at the university and any mainstream venue. And so this is not something you have to sort of look at because a button was found someplace. This is a huge archaeological site going on hundreds of acres, and you can just jump in an airplane and go. So, Ariel, are you still there?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, I was getting a Skype message, and I was just sort of wondering if there was something that was happening. Okay, so basically what happened is that the mainstream view of when civilization started is just completely dead wrong, and the sites are as huge as you can, and you can, as a tourist, just jump on an airplane and go see them. The carbon dating is clear, and Robert Schock talks about that tremendously in his Forgotten Civilization. But you have other books, like, for example, a huge, fat, well-documented book by Michael Cremo called Forbidden Archaeology, which he details site after site, evidence after evidence, in this huge, fat, well-documented book of evidence that is simply not allowed. You can't discuss it on mainstream campuses. You can't discuss it on the universities. Literally, Forbidden Archaeology, and that's the name of his book, clearly showing that human beings have lived contemporaneously with apes going back hundreds of thousands of years. So on an anthropological, I mean, going back millions of years. So on an anthropological basis, to say that a human being popped out of an ape 200,000 years ago, it's just so ridiculous. You can't pop a human being out of an ape in a couple hundred thousand years. You need hundreds of millions of years to do something like that. So a lot of this evidence is simply suppressed, but it's available. And so basically what we're saying is that the idea that there was a civilization on Earth that was more advanced, a little more advanced than we are today, is not unusual if you actually look at the data and are not blindsided by mainstream thoughts. And mainstream here, defined in terms of where the masses are being led. So what basically happened is they drilled a hole in the side of the planet. I'll tell you exactly where they drilled it. And they popped the balloon. That's the other reason this planet is not a good place to live on. This is an 8,000-mile diameter ball of molten rock. And it's covered with an 8-mile-thick crust. That's nothing. We're living on an 8,000-mile diameter ball of liquid molten rock with an 8-mile crust. And when you have these, every 25,000 years, it's not in dispute in the scientific realm, you have these major pole shifts, which are magnetic pole shifts. You're not talking about the Earth flipping in a geographical sense. You're not talking about the movement of the Earth. You're talking about the magnetic poles. They shift and they flip, and they flip quick when they flip. And that happens like every 25,000 years, disrupting the magnetic field around the Earth, severely disrupting the lava flows, the currents, the internal lava currents in the Earth, disrupting the surface of the Earth. And you can say, well, okay, for a couple thousand years, 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000 years, things may be stable. But if you wait long enough, these things happen, and it just throws the civilization that's on the surface of this planet to the dirt, and we have to start all over again. Now, this is what normally happens. It just so happened that this civilization we're calling Atlantis, because it was more advanced, a little more advanced than us, they were lucky. They were simply lucky. Over time, they ran into a string of time in which the major natural catastrophes didn't happen. And when they didn't happen, they were lucky to be able to advance to a high level of technology. The only thing is that they were not done in by a natural disaster. They were done in by themselves. They dug, and it's very clear in the remote viewing data, and it matches the Google Earth pictures and other evidence we have. They dug holes through the crust, thinking they could get to the heat below and utilize that. They ended up popping the balloon, and the entire thing gushed out. They produced an explosion on the side of the planet about the size of the continent of Australia. It was huge. Now, let me tell you exactly where it happened. It happened off the east coast of Australia in the direction of New Zealand. You're talking off the coast of Sydney in the direction of New Zealand. There's three reasons why we can assume that that is the location. Actually, four. That actually corresponds with some of the imagery that was gotten from the remote viewing data. But here are the other three reasons. That spot is called the Admiralty, off the coast of Sydney in the direction of New Zealand. That spot has the thinnest crust. In terms of the overall crust on the surface of the Earth, that has the thinnest crust on the planet. It also has the largest concentration of lava rock anywhere on the planet. And this is the key, listen here, that exact location near New Zealand is the antipode. That means the exact opposite spot on the planet, exact opposite spot on the planet from the anomaly that's on the bottom of the ocean, 3 miles deep, 1,000 miles west of Morocco and Portugal. That thing that we like to call the Atlantis anomaly. You see, if they pop a hole in the planet by drilling down deep through the crust and produce a huge explosion, they're going to release a tremendous amount of pressure. A huge amount of lava is going to pop out. You'll get an explosion that looks like a nuclear bomb times 20, bigger than the size of Australia. And that explosion that actually happens is going to produce a vacuum inside the balloon. And where are you going to get a dent? You're going to get a dent. And where will that dent be? It will be on the exact opposite spot of the planet. And that's exactly where it happened. Meaning, when you go to Portugal, when you go to Morocco, when you go to West Africa, or you go to Portugal, Europe used to extend beyond where it ended now. 70,000 years ago, it extended all the way into the middle of the Atlantic. That spot is the spot that sunk. And it sunk because it was in the location of the antipode of where the drilling occurred, which is down off the coast of Australia, New Zealand, that area, the Admiralty area. So that's how we know that that's where it happened. That's where the lava rock is. That's the thinnest crust on the planet. And it's the exact antipode of the anomaly that we're looking on the bottom of the ocean that we're now calling Atlantis. So why did we decide to call it Atlantis? Well, you know, it was a tough decision because I didn't really want to get involved in the Atlantis mythology, the Atlantis legends. I said, you know, there's so much baggage that goes along with that stuff. But on the other hand, Ariel, the word Atlantis captures the basic idea of a highly technologically advanced society that were on Earth that destroyed itself, not through a natural cataclysm. And there was even the understanding of drilling associated with the legend. So I said, that's enough of a match. If we don't call it Atlantis, other people are going to call it Atlantis anyway, whether we want to or not, because there's enough of a correspondence with the legend. Secondly, how else are we going to call this? Remote viewing evidence of civilization anomaly on the bottom of the ocean, 3 miles deep, 1,000 west of Morocco.
Right.
I mean, I said, how are you going to market this thing? How are you going to tell people from a perspective of getting their interest to look at it what you're talking about in a word or two? So that's how come we decided to use the word Atlantis for this project. It was just easier to call it Atlantis than to use a couple sentences to describe it. I mean, how would you fit a couple sentences on the top of a web page? And how would you fit a couple sentences on the front of a DVD? So anyway, but that's the core. Now, Ariel, this is the most amazing thing. These people had flat panel TV type computer screens, just like we do today, big ones, in their control booths, in their control buildings with the offices and so on. If you were looking at their buildings, I mean, and you can see it with the remote viewing data, we have inside pictures of the offices, the control rooms, people running around, you would swear you were in a place that was controlling scientific experiments today. Well, they had control panels with a lot of dial and button stuff, just like we have today. But they also had neural interfaces between human operators. So they were controlling things with, like, their minds, with neural interfaces. Now, we're doing experiments with that now, and we can get neural interfaces like caps that go on the brain, that go on the skull, that can move. You can actually direct the mouse cursor, the cursor on the screen for the computer. You can actually direct it to the left and the right and things like that. And we're also experimenting with getting imagery from the brain through wires connected to the scalp and so on. But we're not there yet in terms of being able to operationalize this so that they can actually control, you know, drilling operations and things like that. So that's clear that they were a little bit more advanced than us, than we are today. But we're very close because we're experimenting with that technology now. That's how come we know that they were a little bit more advanced. But basically what happened is when they were doing the drilling, they could see that the thing was going to go. They realized it wasn't going to work. They had like a civilian leader that you might call something like a president with the civilian advisors. He was taken by the military and put into what they thought was a secure bunker. It wasn't secure. Everybody died. But the point is, they handled it just like we'd handle it today. But they had enough time when they realized this was a potential extinction-level event, that it was going to wreck life on the planet. They had enough time to actually announce with loudspeakers out on the surface what they had done. And people couldn't believe their ears. They had hundreds of thousands of people on the surface, both down near Antarctica and also in the anomaly area off of Europe, which is 1,000 miles west of Morocco and Portugal. they were listening and they couldn't believe their ears. The authorities were trying to control the masses, but it was basically, you know, people realized it was the end. But they had a few days. And why do we know this? Because they realized it was a potential extinction level event. They also realized that the area that we now see on the bottom of the ocean off the coast of Morocco and Portugal was the antipode for where they were driving, where they were drilling, and it was going to sink. They knew it was going to sink because they actually managed to organize what you might consider some rescue efforts where they were trying to get people to boats. But now this is key, Ariel. Listen to this. They were very careful about who they were putting on the boats. They were putting women who were fecund, who were childbearing or capable of childbearing on those boats. The only men that were allowed on those boats were men who could sail the boats. Other than that, it was women, childbearing and capable of childbearing, fecund women, those were allowed on. Older women were not allowed on. Men were not allowed on. They knew that they were going to have to start civilization over again. They knew this was a potential extinction level event. Now, Ariel, this is something that is sort of unbelievably interesting. Mainstream science, defined in terms of what the masses think, they actually have a theory for this. They know that a huge volcanic event occurred 70,000 years ago. They call it the Toba Catastrophe Theory. That's T-O-B-A, Tango Oscar Bravo Alpha. Toba Catastrophe Theory. And you can look up Toba Catastrophe Theory in Wikipedia. And that refers to Lake Toba in Indonesia, where there is a volcano. They're assuming that Lake Toba was the location of a big volcanic event that killed off everybody on the planet except for 2, 3, 4, 6,000 surviving pairs of people. Meaning, there may have been a few more survivors, but only 2, 3, 4, 6, 8,000 pairs of people were having babies. We are all, and this is not in dispute, we are all the descendants of those 2, 3, 4, 6, 8,000 pairs of individuals that were having babies. Whether you're Aborigine, African, Caucasian, European, Native American, Asian, we are all descendants of those same few thousand people that were killed off 70,000 years ago in this volcanic event. Now, the scientists actually have it sort of correct. They're thinking that the volcanic event occurred in Indonesia. Now, if you're looking at the entire globe, that's not bad, because there is a volcano in Indonesia. There is Lake Toba. But that's actually in the same quadrant of the planet. That's actually in the same realm that we're talking about. But the thing is that Indonesia is on the east, actually it's north of Australia. They almost got it right. It didn't happen, however, at Lake Toba. It didn't happen north of Australia. It happened east of Australia. But you're still in the same general area on the globe. So they almost got it correct. We now know that it was the area east of Sydney, not the area directly north of Australia, but the area east of Sydney where the explosion happened, because that's the thinnest spot of the crust on the planet. That's where the lava rock is. The highest concentration on the planet is there, and that's the exact antipode for the spot in the Atlantic that sunk. So that's how we know where it actually happened. So that's the basic story. Now, there's a lot of big stuff and a lot of detail that is the type that keeps you on the edge of your seat when you actually see the detail, the last 5 days of what happened. And then I said in the beginning of the interview, it's verifiable. Why? Because we have the Google Earth imagery that can't be walked away from. And you have Google Earth 2.0 that sort of washes a lot of it away, but not all of it. And you have a good reason to say that Google 2.0 imagery is not done right. Now, I'm not saying it's that scientists, that any scientist or institute conspired to corrupt the Google Earth data. But I am saying it's good to remember that these are governmental data originally, and the government can do whatever they want with the data before anyone else gets their hold on it. And they are having to use compression algorithms, and the compression algorithms do, in fact, do smoothing. And it's simply a matter of ratcheting up the level of compression to get rid of anything that they want to get rid of. So my opinion is that the original Google Earth imagery is very clearly the best, where the level of compression wasn't so great. And it totally matches both the volcanic evidence on the surface, the remote viewing data, and in both locations, the Antarctica region as well as the Atlantic Ocean region, the anomaly still didn't go away. It's still there. It's just not so glaringly obvious in the new version of Google Earth. But there's a good reason to dismiss the new version of Google Earth and to look at the original, because that's where the color gradient is more in its original form. And you can really see the anomaly so clearly with it. So for those people who'd like to get the whole thing, Ariel, the DVD is really a must. I must say something here, that we're a nonprofit. So we rely on contributions just like everybody else to do it. We do not have a lot of money. We have a couple thousand bucks in the bank, and we don't get any National Science Foundation grants. And so we really rely on people supporting us. This is a viewer-supported enterprise. We're all volunteers here. And so when you get the DVD, you actually not only get the full story, but you're helping us out with the doing of our next project and the project after that. The money goes towards doing what we do, and there is no other source of income that we have that is traditional, such as National Science Foundation grants or something. It's we're all living off of our kitchen budget. So this, I've never in my life seen such important research done at such a high quality, done by so few people with so few resources. So this DVD, by the way, is first rate in terms of the quality of the production, so we're really happy with that. But it really does spell out the whole thing. The only thing I really would like to encourage people that if you do get the DVD, please show it to your friends and relatives. Don't just watch it you yourself and then put it in a drawer. Let the word get out. And bring your relatives over. Put your son and daughter in front of it. Put your grandmother in front of it. And bring your neighbors over. Serve them tea and let them see it. So the information really has to get out. If we want to change the planet, we're not going to do it by a presidential announcement. We're going to do it with one person at a time, and it's the word of mouth. Because you can't get this in the New York Times. You can't get this in CNN. You can't get it in any mainstream university setting, but we can get it on your show, Ariel. That's important to note.
Well, I totally agree, and I do encourage everyone to pick up the DVD. And the real value in understanding the mistakes of history is that we don't repeat it.
You know, Ariel, you're raising a crucial point here. Let's look at what we do with secrecy-cloaked science. Secrecy-cloaked science is what we do normally. We run our whole society, whether it's meetings of the Federal Reserve Board, meetings between the President and the Congress. We do everything in secret. When you look at secrecy-cloaked science, take a look at Fukushima. That nuclear power plant that went belly up, Fukushima Daiichi, that was a very typical construction of power plants that are all over the planet, thousands of them. And what they have is they have nuclear power rods, spent nuclear fuel that is in swimming pools. Now, in the Fukushima Daiichi plant for reactor number 4, the swimming pool was put up in an upper level story of a multi-level building. They didn't even put it down at ground level. So if you were to go there now, the swimming pool that's holding the reactor rods, that if they, spilled out, you could talk about possible destruction of all life on Earth. If they're in a building in an upper level floor that's got an earthquake rating of zero. Basically, they're telling you a kid could knock it over if he kicked it. And the building has sunk 37 feet during the original earthquake, and it sunk another 30 feet since then, and now they're concerned because it's beginning to tilt. And there's a very real problem, possibility that it's just going to fall over. Now, they've not taken the rods out. They don't know how to get the rods out. They're pumping water after water after water and then storing it in 600,000 tons of containers and pipes that are bolted together, not even welded. They're not even recycling the water. They're just storing it into a huge, you're going to eventually have Lake Superior of water, of radioactive water in these containers that are rickety. And it's growing. It's totally unsustainable. And so what you basically have is so-called specialist scientists, engineers conducting plants with secrecy. Remember how many people used to complain, is this safe? Is this safe? And the engineers, the scientists, the governmental authorities would say, you people are idiots. You don't know anything. Leave it up to us. We're the experts. We know how to do this type of thing. Poo, poo, poo. Just go away. And they didn't tell you what they were really doing until the plant melts down. And then we're talking about the complete destruction of the ecosystem in the Pacific Ocean, possibly, very real possibly. We're talking about the very real possibility of evacuating at least Tokyo, which is not far away from it, and possibly all of Japan. We're talking about if the plutonium actually gets into the environment, we're talking about a potential extinction level stuff. Now, the thing is that what's happening in Fukushima Daiichi is exactly the same. It's what's happening in all the nuclear power plants everywhere. They all have these swimming pools. Now, not all of them are up on multi-story buildings, but they're all dependent upon water circulatory systems that run off of the electrical power grid. And if we were to get one coronal mass ejection, even a small one like what happened in 1859, the cooling system would shut down in every single one of them. The pools would dry up within a matter of hours or days, and the fuel rods would melt. And this is not just one or two plants. You're talking about essentially all of the plants. They have no place to put the spent nuclear fuel rods anywhere. And so you're talking about a major disaster, and it was all done in secrecy without telling people what's really going on. Let's look at another example, genetically modified foods. Now, genetically modified foods are foods that have been genetically manipulated normally so that they can withstand higher concentrations of pesticides so that factory farms can make these plants grow by dumping increased concentrations of chemicals on top of them. Now, the problem with genetically modified foods is the plants are little factories of chemicals. Not only do they have the pesticides on top of them and inside, but they also themselves are chemically different than the ones that our bodies were used to growing up with. So it's that the plants themselves have stuff in them that our bodies really don't know what to do with. That's the problem. Now, 20 years ago, then 15, and then 10, when these genetically modified foods were just starting, it was said, don't worry, we're just experimenting with them. And we will make sure, I don't know if you're old enough to remember these newspaper stories that used to come out, we will make sure that none of the seeds escape into the wild. We will make sure that we're just experimenting. We're seeing what's going to happen. And don't worry, we're not going to do this. We're not going to change the food supply system. Some years went by, and in fact, 80% of all the food that's grown on the planet is now genetically modified. No one announced that it was going to happen. In fact, they announced that it wasn't going to happen and that they were going to protect it. And of course, it was secrecy cloaked science. So I am a scientist. I love science. But what I don't like is secrecy cloaked science. Now look at what happened in Atlantis, a so-called Atlantis days only 70,000 years ago. The scientists had their secrecy cloaked experiment and they killed everybody. Ariel, they even killed themselves. They killed all the scientists. They killed the political leadership that authorized the experiment. They killed the industrial leadership. They killed the military. They killed everybody. There was only 6,000 surviving pairs of breeding people. That means there was only a few thousand people that were left on the planet. They were all done in. So what we have here is secrecy cloak science is not only bad for everybody else, but it's also bad for the scientists. Now, you know as well as I do that governmental authorities, industrial people, science people, and military people, they don't like prying eyes. They don't like people that really have less of an awareness of the science of things putting their heads over their shoulders and telling people, you know, what they think. They don't like people getting meddling in their affairs, because what that means is that essentially uneducated people about this subject are asking questions and demanding answers, and it takes resources for the governments and the industrial people and the science people to make these explanations, and sometimes the masses don't understand the explanations. But what eventually happens is that the people that are doing the experiments, they say, rather than educate the masses and deal with bureaucratic oversight, extra cost, educating the masses, rather than deal with that, it's easier to simply not tell anybody, not tell the masses, and do it secretly. But we have gotten to a point in our society where the toys that we can make are sufficiently dangerous that they can kill off everybody, including the scientists. So in the evolution of a society, of a civilization, you get to a point in which the technology requires oversight. And it's not just the oversight of the technical experts. It's the oversight of the uneducated masses as well, because we're all in this together, especially when we live on the surface of a balloon that has a very fragile environment in which civilization gets knocked down to a pulp every few thousand years. We are all in this, and we've got to pull this together. That means in our particular setting, we have to tolerate educating the masses as we go along, and we have to tolerate the bureaucratic oversight, the questions from people who don't know what they're talking about. We have to tolerate the efforts to educate everybody to what we're doing. And we have to tolerate the oversight that occasionally will say, no, you can't do that. If you want to do it, build yourself a rocket, go to some other place like the moon and do it there, but you're not doing it here. We have to tolerate that sometimes happens. That must happen, because if we don't tolerate that, we'll kill ourselves, all of ourselves, including the scientists. That's the long story for what you said when you said, if we want to change things, we have to learn from our past. That's why the government, the military, the industrial complex doesn't want, they know perfectly well what's on the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. That's why they don't want that out. That's why they want this covered up. That's why it's not taught in the mainstream media, at the university level and others. Because if it was known publicly what we did to ourselves 70,000 years ago, the public would rise up. They would demand all types of other stuff. And those military authorities, industrial authorities, scientific authorities, governmental authorities, they don't want that oversight. But what I'm arguing is there's no escape from it. You have to educate the masses along the way, and you have to acknowledge that there's going to be some things that you're not going to be allowed to do. There's going to be some toys that you're not going to be allowed to play with, because they demonstrably can kill everybody. So you can say, okay, this happened 70,000 years ago. We just won't drill into the core of the planet. We'll be safe. Let us do whatever we want. Look at Fukushima Daiichi. That could potentially kill off everybody by itself, and that's just one nuclear power plant. And there's tens of thousands of them out there that all have the same fundamental structural flaws. I mean, and that's just that. We're not talking about the other issues that there can be severe risk associated with. So that's why this Atlantis thing is so important. It's the big thumb that's stuck right in your eye. You can't avoid the anomaly that's on the bottom of the ocean. It's huge. Both locations. Now, I'm not saying there's not other locations, but I'm saying these are the two big gorillas on the block. So we looked at those locations. You can't avoid them. It's like trying to avoid the ruins of Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, hundreds of acres of ruins with stonework equivalently complex and as mysterious as the pyramids in Giza. You can't avoid it. They're just there, and the carbon dating is clear as day. So this type of thing tells us what we need to know about our past. We face not just natural cataclysms on this planet, but we also face man-made cataclysms on this planet. And what we need to do as a society, as a civilization, is to last long enough this time around so that we can get off this rock. That's the bottom line. If we don't learn from our mistakes, we're going to kill ourselves off, just like we did 70,000 years ago. It may be a different thing we do. Maybe we don't drill into the crust, but maybe it'll be a nuclear thing. But it's clear as day through the evidence that we have that we are involved in highly risky behavior and that we are not going to survive unless we modify what we do. And we have to modify based on learning from the past. It's not that drilling through the crust was a dangerous thing. It was not educating the public as to what was going on. It was the secrecy cloak science. Don't point at the specifics of one instance, because if it wasn't that thing, it would have been something else. It's the secrecy cloak science that is the serious problem. And so what we are in a situation of is we're in a situation where we have to get off this rock, because if it's not a man-made disaster, we don't have long to wait. There will be a natural disaster which will drive us down to the ground again, and we'll be going through the same phase of going through the hunter-gatherer stage, and then people will have a civilization again, and people will be saying that civilization just started up and before that nothing existed. We'll be doing the same thing all over again. This is the second time on our planet's history that we've got a sufficiently capable technology that we are within the near grasp. We're not there yet, but we're in the near grasp of being able to have the technological capacity to move off this planet. If we can survive another 500 years or maybe even 1,000, we will be able to leave. And that is the only destiny for humanity. We have to get off the rock. This planet is perfectly designed as a botanical and zoological paradise, a botanical and zoological garden. But that's it. It's not appropriate for a civilization. A civilization, we have a very thick atmosphere. The weather is horrific. The earthquakes over are horrific. The coronal mass ejections are horrific. The very fact that we live on a lava ball is horrific. This is not a place where we can survive as a coherent civilization for 1,000,000 years. We need a stable environment to do that. We need to get off the rock. And so the secrecy cloak science will kill us before we have the chance to get off the rock. That's the key. That's why secrecy cloak science has to end. We have to last long enough to get off the rock.
Well, I could just say we have a caller with a question for you, which I'd like to make sure we have time for. But I'm listening to what you're saying, and I see the time, you know, exactly. I see what you're saying, and the one thing that I would like to add is that we keep coming back through this technology ladder, going through getting more and more technological. And the thing that's out of balance is that the spiritual side is not developing as quickly, so there's an imbalance. And in the big picture, that's really what happened in Atlantis was the imbalance between the technological advancement and the spiritual advancement. Because if you have the spiritual advancement, the question is, yes, we can do this, but should we? And that question was never answered, because living in a technological society on a botanical paradise is incongruent.
Yeah. Now, let me say this much, Ariel, that we're currently in a little worse situation than the Atlanteans, because the remote viewing data is very clear on this. We no longer have to deal with myths or legends. We have real hard, solid photographic evidence of the ruins. We have solid remote viewing data collected by the best remote viewers on the planet, military grade, under totally scientifically blind conditions, under perfect scientific experimental conditions. So the point is that in these data are extremely persuasive with regard to what happens. One of the things that they did come across within the data, there's a lot of things that are on the DVD that I haven't covered here, is that the Atlanteans were very much involved with some mental practices that you would call spiritual in nature, in the sense of telepathy. They were really big on telepathy. They got the bugs worked out of this. We have a genetics that suppresses telepathic communication a lot, to the point where in our current society most people don't even think they have it. So, but the Atlanteans had clearly not suppressed that. So even with that understanding, they still were focusing on the physical, and they still were doing secrecy cloaked, very dangerous experiments. Now, our current situation is a little bit more dangerous than theirs, in the sense that the widespread acceptance of telepathy doesn't even exist on our current society. So at least in the Atlantean days, they understood telepathy, and they were experimenting with other forms of mind-matter interactions, such as psychokinesis. They were experimenting with things like that. They did not suppress it by saying it doesn't exist, which is what happens now. So we're in a situation where our current society, our scientific establishment, is trying to maintain a myth that is totally unsupportable with available data, that psychokinesis, telepathy, remote viewing simply does not exist. Now, they're maintaining this view by ignoring scientific results. They're ignoring the archaeological evidence, for example, that Robert Schock, the Boston University professor, so clearly describes. They're ignoring the even further gone back archaeological data that Michael Cremo describes in his Forbidden Archaeology. So in terms of civilization stuff, they're simply ignoring data. And what does that mean, and how do we connect it to regular mainstream science? Well, that means that regular mainstream science and archaeological stuff, which is so, the reason I'm bringing up the archaeological connection is the evidence for that is so overwhelming and is right in front of you, that you can say, wow, they really do have an issue. The scientists really do have a fundamental problem going on. So the evidence is so clear that what they are doing is connecting the dots, but they're only connecting the dots that they want to allow into their theories. One of the biggest and most common mistakes that is made by mainstream science, remember, I am a scientist at a major university, but I do not do this remote viewing research at my university. I'm an applied mathematician that works in a social science program. But mainstream scientists are my colleagues, and what they do in universities all over the world is they connect the dots, but they connect only the dots that they want to look at. And the biggest mistake that I see so commonly done in mainstream science, is to look for data that support their theory. Now listen to those words. They look for data that can support their theory. That means they're connecting the dots, but they're only connecting the dots that they want to look at. You cannot look for data that support your theory. You have to use all the available data and throw your theory against it. You can't collect the data that support your theory. You have to look at all the data. If I wanted to look for data that support my theory, I could have a theory that gravity only works going upwards. And the only data that I will look at, I'll look for all data that will support my theory. And every time I see a kid throwing a ball upward, I'll look at it. Every time I see anything going upward, I'll look at it. But I'll never look at anything that's falling back down. I'll only look at data for things going up. And I will have a theory that will be 100% supported by the data. Things only go up. Gravity only goes upwards. I'm not allowing in the rest of the data. And that's what mainstream scientists do.
Their egos are so big, and they have a need to be right and maintain their positions of power. So
it's a very complicated psychological story that goes way beyond what we have the ability to talk about today. It's not just a matter of ego. It's a very complicated scientific stuff. For example, up until 1995.
Excuse me.
Yes, we only have a few minutes left here.
Let's wrap it up then. Go ahead.
I know you have some callers that want to ask a question. Please, we only have about 10 minutes, so let someone call in and ask a question. And make your answer as brief as you can.
Absolutely.
Okay, yeah, I know this is such a fascinating subject, and we could probably talk for another couple of hours, but they cut us off at 2 hours. So we just have one caller with a question, and we're going to pick him up right now and see. We're going to be talking to Ralph as soon as your microphone gets open. Hi, Ralph. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate you bringing me on. Courtney, I've heard you before, and I've never heard you talk so negatively about our planet before, and I was just wondering where that came from. But and my question really is directed to the information you gave about the remote viewers, and I still have not gotten clear as to how this technology is used to pinpoint a particular timeline when there are an infinite number of timelines and relate it back to this timeline. How do you choose exactly what timeline they're actually remote viewing?
Okay, good question. Great question. First of all, I have to be very brief here, but there's a couple things. I have in other interviews spoken about the nature of the planet, but I don't do that in every interview, meaning every interview I have, I always say new things. I don't just repeat myself. So the fact that I have spoken about the planet, I told you when I said it, it's going to be very difficult for people to wrap their heads around it, but put it together yourself. We live on an 8,000-mile diameter ball of liquid rock. Add two and two together. This is not a good place to be. Okay.
I think it's actually a bunch of fear porn. I really don't believe in anything that you said about that, and I know you don't have time to get into that, but I was just wondering if you could address the question about the remote viewers.
Yes, the question about the remote viewers, actually, you asked a number of, what was the most important part of the question, because you actually had three parts. So what was the important part that you want me to answer?
Yes, so how do we pinpoint the particular timeline?
Okay, the timeline. Now, the issue is here. When we remote view the future, timeline issues is always a difficult thing, and I've got many experiments that we've done at the Farsight Institute dealing with trying to describe the future. So that's a very complicated thing, but remote viewing the past never produces that problem because you're always dealing with a historical event that has some real physical evidence right in front of you. And in this case, we have the pictures on the bottom of the ocean. Now, in terms of how do we know, like, which timeline it was, we know which timeline we're able to select out of a multiplicity of timelines because it's the timeline that produced that anomaly that's on the bottom of the ocean. Now, does that address it, or did you want me to get at a different aspect to it?
I don't want you to get any more technical than that. I know you can be real technical on that, but that's sufficient. And I appreciate all the information you've given tonight. And by the way, that area that you covered about the new line control and that being something that the government is proficient in, they are pretty proficient in mind control right now. And a technology called TAMI, T-A-M-I, stands for the Thought Amplifier and Mind Interface. It's actually in play, and a lot of people are being affected by it.
It's very important for me in this interview and all interviews that I go into is to stick only with the data that we actually have. And I don't have any information about this issue that you're raising now. So I really want to say that once I start on a topic, I want to make sure I stick to the topic. And the very information that we have is enough to really, you know, make someone have to sit down. It's a huge amount. But when it gets to other things that we don't know about, I like to tell people, hey, I don't know a lot about a lot of things. And for example, people say, hey, look, if you're so good with all those remote viewing studies, then you must know everything about everything. Who killed John Kennedy? And I had to look at them and I had to say, to be quite honest, I have no idea who killed John Kennedy. I mean, we don't know everything about anything. So you've asked about a topic that I know it's of great interest to many people, but I have to tell you when we don't know something, and that's just something we don't know about.
You don't know about it. Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate your information. You've been a good host, a good guest. Take care. Good night.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ralph. Well, we do have about 3 minutes left here, so if you would like to summarize or make a concluding...
Sure. Well, the most important thing that I'd like to do is two things. The first of all is that we're a nonprofit, and we do not take out any advertising to tell people what we're doing. When we conclude another project, and we're right in the middle of a project that is going to knock your socks off, it's really incredibly great. When we do a project, the only thing we do is put it up on our webpage and announce it on our newsletter. Our newsletter is free. We don't give out the email addresses to anybody. And we very rarely send it out, like once every few months. So there's no reason not to be on it. So what I want to encourage everybody to do is to sign up for our free newsletter. We have no other way to get a hold of you and to actually tell you, you know, our projects take like a year or more to finish. So when we actually get it done, we announce it. So if you go to our webpage, www.farsight.org, farsight.org, and go down to the bottom of the nav bar on the left, you'll see a big blue banner that says subscribe to our free newsletter. Just click it, put your email address and your screen name, and just you're done. You will get it. And it's free. We don't give out the email addresses, and you won't get a lot of spam from us because we hardly ever send one out. But when we send one out, it's big news. And we've got one coming up. We've got a new project coming up. So I really want to encourage people to get on our mailing address for the free newsletter. Doesn't cost anything, no reason not to do it. The other thing is farsight.org. Click on the big banner on our homepage right in the middle to see the first 15 minutes of the DVD. It's free. It's right on YouTube. Get the whole background for it. See the imagery yourself. And if that's not enough motivation to say, hey, I want to see what the rest is, I don't know what could be. So I hope you do get a chance to see the whole DVD. All the remote viewing data, the original scans and so on, have been on our website for a while. They're all available free because we're a nonprofit. But pulling it all together requires people to sit down and take a look at what happened during the last 5 days of that society. And that's why we use the word Atlantis. It matches a lot with what the legends of Atlantis have in their essential categories, which is a high technology civilization that destroyed itself and sunk. And now we know where they were, what they did, when they did it, and how it all happened. So it's a riveting story. It's probably the most riveting story that's ever happened on our planet.
Well, I have to agree, and we just have a few seconds left here. So, Courtney Brown, I want to thank you so much for joining us this evening. I encourage everybody to go to farsight.org and check it out and sign up for the newsletter. So with that, thank you so much, Courtney, for joining us.
And thank you so much for inviting me.
You're so welcome. And from everybody here at Starseed Radio Academy, thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Starseed Radio Academy. Visit our website at www.starseedhotline.com.